TCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Radio Dialect is produced by the Bristol Radio Co-op and is run by volunteers. I'm Tim Elliott from Amnesty International, and I'm here to talk about the debate held at the Watershed last Wednesday, the theme of which was the European elections. The question time event Your Planet, Your Rights was organised by the Southwest-based Amnesty International, Friends of the Earth and Oxfam groups. The questions dealt with climate change, human rights and international development. Climate change is costing lives right now, and in vulnerable countries, seasons are being thrown out of sync, agriculture is failing, and water supplies drying up. In the seemingly never-ending race towards a global capitalist society, the demand for energy is increasing day by day. How this energy is extracted has a significant impact on the global climate, but also on the lives of people in countries where the extraction of energy resources is widespread. The rights and freedoms of individuals in five countries are being compromised by the need of security of supply of energy to feed our intensive Western society. The development of institutions like the European Union is an important start to helping achieve a greater sense of global unity. With 500 million inhabitants, Europe is the most populated democratically governed region in the world, even greater than the United States. So it is important to keep engaged with this political system to ensure that the influence it has represents the values that we stand for. In sponsoring an event like this, our groups aimed to keep the members of the public engaged with the European political process, be able to make them have a better informed decision on their vote at the upcoming elections in June, and also feel that the Southwest MEPs, and whatever party they stand for, are mindful of the environment and human rights issues and are willing to listen to members of the public. The debate consisted of five MEP candidates and was chaired by Bob Constantine, the former ITV West political editor. In this special report on the event, we will discuss the comments made by the candidates during the event and in the interviews after. The candidates on the panel and subsequently interviewed by Dialect's reporter Anthea Page were Ricky Knight from the Green Party, Kay Barnard for the Lib Dems, Keir Dillon from the Labour Party, Dr. Julia Reid from the UK Independent Party, and Ashley Fox from the Conservative Party. So, now over to the Green Party candidate.
Hello, I'm Ricky Knight. I'm the lead candidate for the Green Party for the Southwest European elections on June the 4th. I aspire to be the first Green MEP for the Southwest to represent us in Brussels.
So what's the burning issue with the Green Party?
The burning issue is the planet, I suppose. And that's two words together. The burning planet, climate change. But the burning issue, the really important issue, is climate change. It's the greatest threat to mankind ever. And it's unfortunately been subsumed in the election because of the Westminster scandals. But nonetheless, that is my overriding concern. It's the fact that our CO2 emissions are leading to a greenhouse effect, which is upping the temperatures. We all know this is happening, apart from one person on the panel tonight, and it's my number one concern. But if you're looking for a general policy or general world, I think the word that really underwrites our policies for the European and the national elections would be sustainability. In all things.
You were very passionate about trade. I think the Conservatives said something about free trade.
Free trade, fair trade.
Yeah, and you were very serious about that. Can you tell us why?
Oh, yes. Well, because free trade, in terms of its description, in terms of what it means, essentially means that you drive for profit. And if you drive for profit, you beggar thy neighbour. It's a race to the bottom, and the people who benefit the least are the people in the developing nations, the poorer people, the poorer subsistence farmers, who are exploited by multinational and globalised companies. And the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. That is free trade. It's absolutely the case that if you strive for profit, I'm afraid the first thing that goes is fair trade. I cannot really square the commitment all the other parties have, and the EU as a conglomerate, as a, the largest exporting nation and the largest GNP organisation in the world, the fact that they, how can we square the drive that they have for free trade with their lip service to fair trade? You know, as I said tonight, they think that we're being fair trade, we're supporting fair trade because we're against sweatshops or we buy fair trade chocolate or fair trade coffee, but it's much, much bigger than that.
Because there was a very worrying question about animal fodder from Brazil.
They
cut it down the rainforest.
Yes.
For the soya bean.
That's a knock-on effect,
us,
yeah.
Can you tell us some more about that?
Well, that's a knock-on effect of Europe being such a light bulb for exporters and multinational companies. Because of our intensive farming to feed our absolute craving for cheap food and rubbish food half the time, I'm afraid, we exert huge pressures on the on the international market for animal feedstuffs. Our intensive farm, poultry, pigs and cattle need high protein. The best source of high protein since foot and mouth disease, which prior to that had been blood and bone and animals, animal content, which caused all the problems. Since the legislation's forbidden that to be part of a livestock diet, we brought in concentrated protein from mostly from South America, Argentina, Brazil and Paraguay, where I think it's up to 75% of the soybean crop comes to Western Europe for animal feedstuffs. What happens is, because the soybean, which very often is genetically modified, which I'm absolutely fundamentally against as well, and again, it's genetically modified to make sure that crop yields are greater, and that's not a good thing, I'm afraid. The knock-on effect of that is that soybean farms knock out the cattle ranches. I won't go down the road of explaining why I think, but cattle and beef production is such a worry to, in terms of climate change and CO2 emissions. And in turn, the cattle ranches then decimate the forest because they need to find more space for their cattle, and the fertile lands go to soya. The Amazonian jungle increasingly is being cut down to feed our need for beef and burgers, for instance. And then the exploitation of the local subsistence farmers and the indigenous population, leading to malnutrition and enforced poverty and whole populations being forced off their land. I called it the butterfly effect. That's what happens. Something happens in Western Europe and the effect is felt right across the Atlantic.
So the government stopped smoking virtually, haven't they?
Yes.
Places. So why can't they stop production of meat if it's causing all this devastating effect on the planet? Why couldn't they just put a meat ban on it?
Meat ban. I got into a bit of trouble with this. I wholeheartedly support Viva's Eat Green campaign, and I've signed up to it, and they've sent my quotes around the national press. It hit my local press, and I endorsed the public to consider eating less meat, which got misconstrued in my farming community as Green Party candidate's edict to stop people eating meat. Well, I might think that personally, but that's not what I'm saying at all. It's that every individual has to address or consider whether or not eating less meat is going to be a good thing for themselves, for their own personal health, and also for the climate. It's absolutely the case. Methane emissions and livestock production, intensive farming, creates over 24% of the world's CO2 emissions. Eating less meat will obviously have a much better effect on the environment, and to be honest, it'll have a lot better effect on your health as well.
Are there any figures to show that, say, if people cut down on eating meat two or three times a week,
yes,
whether that would have significant effect on climate change?
Well, absolutely,
just by changing their habit.
Yeah, and the figures are there. I don't know them off the tip of my tongue, but I do believe there is a place for legislation here, and I think it begins in the public services. I was a teacher for 30 years, and one of the things I was so proud of doing was getting in there before Jamie Oliver did. Our school introduced a healthy, balanced diet, kicked out the Coke machines, and got rid of the chips on an everyday option long before Jamie Oliver came into fashion. Although I'm not knocking Jamie, he's done a great job, but it starts with the publicly owned or the municipal outlets like schools, civic centres, hospitals, the armed forces. They must introduce a balanced and healthy diet and make sure that the food comes from locally sourced and sustainable farming methods and genetically modified no thank you. There's so much that legislation can do, so much that local authorities can do to encourage returning the control of food production to the locality, introducing farmers' markets and thereby hopefully breaking the monopoly of the supermarkets, which I'm afraid, it has to be said, we all shop there, I do too, I'm not holier than thou about it, but the supermarkets and our striving for cheap food has caused all the problems of intensive farm production and is bankrupting every day local farms who can't maintain the standards that the major supermarket chains impose upon them.
So do you think the government should put more constraints on the more aggressive, I'm not going to name anyone, but
well,
the more
I will.
Aggressive supermarkets that I think they want to take over another space in Bristol near the football stadium?
Well, we can't disinvent cars, we can't disinvent aeroplanes, we can't disinvent supermarkets, but we can certainly make them better. It might be whimsical, but excuse me, listeners, it might be whimsical. Two little things we could do all individually, and that is, when we get to a queue in a supermarket, insist that whoever comes up to help us helps us unpack the packaging to give it back to the supermarket. I'd love that to happen. Give all the packaging back, make the polluter pay. And the other thing, which I think is absolutely possible,
I
but nobody.
That anyway.
Well, good for you. I think it's absolutely possible we could do this as consumers, and I do believe in people power can change the habits, the bad habits of large conglomerates like the ones you didn't mention, is we could stop buying from supermarkets. Because supermarkets have bankrupted my local record store, they've bankrupted the local post office, they've bankrupted local fishmongers, the local corner shops, they've taken the business away. They've taken the heart and soul out of towns, rural towns and city centres, because they suck everybody into these out-of-town centres, and there they buy their cheap tellies, their cheap clothes, sweatshop clothes.
But they've become a social centre as well, which
Well, I worry about that. Are you? Yeah, fair enough. Have a cup of tea. Sorry.
They take over the whole community, so the supermarket becomes the community.
Well, this is what happened center. In the States, isn't it? You built all your urban settlements outside of the cities. You then gave them a shopping mall, and they drive to the shopping mall, and they live in an anesthetized world, and it's no life at all.
But we
to
don't
me.
Drive everywhere like the Americans, do we?
We're certainly better than... Oh, you and I might walk, but I'm afraid there's still a lot of people who use unnecessary car journeys. That's another issue, isn't it? But I'm afraid if people go to Tesco's to socialise, apart from a cup of coffee and a cheap bun or whatever, then that is the heart and soul of the community being ripped out, you know. To me, just walking up my town centre in Barnsville or walking through the streets here in Bristol, that's such a buzz. That's real people, you know. In fact, I'm not the best of consumers, to be honest, but I do get a real buzz from the community buzz that every time I walk from Gloucester Road to our HQ here in Old Market Street. I just love it. I love the energy and the community spirit here.
So do you think farmers markets are getting more popular now?
There must be, yes. I was instrumental in setting up our farmers market back down in Ilfracombe, near where I live. Absolutely, farmers markets are just the only way. The produce is local, it keeps the money in the community. I was also going, it's a little bit of a tangent, but it's an interesting one, because the West Country being a tourist spot, you know, so many people on these self-catering holidays, they drive into a community, they shop at a supermarket, 80% of the money they spend in a supermarket goes straight out of the county, you know. They must shop locally, go to the local farmer's market, buy your local healthy, it might not be organic necessarily, or because you can't get the seal of approval. The Soil Association won't necessarily give it to your local small holdings. It's difficult to get, isn't it? But you know you're getting something that hasn't been sprayed with pesticides. It's local, it's in season. It might not even be cheaper, but cheaper doesn't mean better. It's got
just
much better
less.
Taste. Or eat less would be a good option as well. We consume far too much, don't we? Yeah.
Good luck.
Well, we're on the crest of a wave, I must admit. If we're the recipient, the Green Party become the recipient of the disenfranchised angry vote, then I'll take the votes for wherever they come. I think we are an honourable and integrally honest and accountable party. Our leader, Caroline Lucas, has just been awarded the accolade of being UK's European MEP, most respected for her proactive stance on accountability and open democracy. She's an exceptional MEP, and if people turn to the Greens as being their natural recipient of the angry vote, I'll be only too proud and pleased, yeah.
That was Anthea Page talking to Ricky Knight from the Green Party.
You're listening to Dialect Radio, one of the programmes produced for the Bristol Radio Co-op, run by volunteers.
The next candidate to be interviewed was from the Lib Dems.
I'm Kay Barnard, and I'm second on the Liberal Democrat list for the European elections in the South West.
Can you tell us a bit about this evening?
Oh, it was a very interesting debate around environmental issues and human rights issues, and it was very well attended, so I was very pleased.
And what are the Lib Dems' aspirations for the election? What sort of major issue are they going to be putting forward?
Well, Liberal Democrats think that Britain is much stronger by being a member of the European Union, that we can tackle problems together with our European neighbours that we cannot tackle on our own as a country. And of those, the environment is an important issue, because there's no way that Britain can influence world events on its own.
Do you think, though, the EU plays too much a part sometimes with rules and regulations? There's too much of that?
I think there's too much in the way of rules and regulations from every angle, from the British government and probably from the EU. What we need is less but better regulation, and that the decisions that are taken about people's lives should be taken at the right level. So there are decisions that should be taken by the British government, but there are decisions where we need to work with our neighbours and take decisions at that level, like the environment and international crime.
Can you tell us a bit about sustainable energy? Because you're a farmer, I believe, in Somerset.
I am indeed, yes. Well, there's a variety of alternative technologies that are available. I mean, we would want to fund research into things like tidal power and biofuels. Well, we're not particularly in favour of the Severn Barrage because of the huge environmental consequences it would have on the Severn Estuary and on the Port of Bristol. We would look at alternative types of alternative ways of harnessing the power of the Severn Estuary, which is considerable and should be harnessed. So we would look at things like tidal flow fences or reefs, and possibly the lagoon system, where you can store water for after high tide and then let it go out through, again, turbines to generate electricity.
What about Norway and Sweden? Can we learn lessons from them?
Absolutely, we can learn lessons, particularly Norway, where they generate all their electricity from hydroelectricity. So, I mean, there is a lot to be learned. We should be looking at a whole basket of technologies for Britain.
I mean, we're surrounded by sea, so why aren't we doing more about hydro fuels?
No, hydroelectricity requires water to flow down from a hill, and so we should be, I mean, we do have the capacity to generate hydroelectricity, and there is hydroelectricity generated in Scotland and Wales, but there we could be utilising it a lot more across Britain.
What about wind power?
Yes, I think we should be using the wind as well. We're a small windy island, and we should be utilising all these natural resources that we have here in the southwest. It's largely the British government's reluctance to invest.
Well, aren't they worried about...
You would have thought so. You would have thought so. And I certainly am, and I would invest. And the Liberal Democrats would invest in all these different sorts of alternative technologies, renewable technologies.
So if anyone wants to contact the Lib Dems, how would they go about it?
Well, they can look on the internet. I have a website. Our campaign team has a website.
So what's your website?
My own website is just Kay Barnard, isn't it? I think if you Google me, you'll find me.
Okay, thank you.
That was Anthea Page talking to Kay Barnard from the Lib Dems.
You're listening to Dialect Radio, one of the programmes produced for the Bristol Radio Co-op, run by volunteers.
The theme running very much throughout Kay's responses in the evening was about the environment and energy supply. The Liberal Democrats have got a very progressive policy on energy. Kay was also asked about human trafficking in the EU and the care that post-traffic victims are given. We asked this question to the panel because the implementation of the Convention on Human Trafficking and its transposition into UK law was not felt by Amnesty to go far enough. When victims are first discovered, often the female victims are seen by male police, they are thought of as criminals, and in some cases, because they don't have passports, they have actually been put in prison for several months. This is the last thing somebody wants that has just spent a few years basically incarcerated in this country. What they need is support from specialist care workers and from NGOs at the outset. And post-care must be complementary and full. At the moment, there is only one project in England, the Poppy Project in London, that actually cares for post-traffic victims of the sex trade. It has 35 beds, but considering that 1,400 people are trafficked into the UK every year, this seems pretty dismal. What Kay did say was that we needed better information on organised crime groups, as a lot of the human trafficking within the European Union comes from these large-scale organised crime syndicates. She also mentioned that the European arrest warrant, promoted by the Liberal Democrats, has been a great success. Unfortunately, she did not give any indication as to exactly how they might support further care projects for post-traffic victims in the UK.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Time now for the next candidate interview, which comes from the Labour Party.
My name's Keir Dillon. I'm the Labour candidate for the European elections, number three on the list for the South West. And I'm standing on a ticket to ensure that fairness, justice and proper financial regulation are campaigning issues, along with making sure that we have proper controls on environmental and climate change.
Are you worried about the result of the election this year? In terms of Labour voters?
There are plenty of people out there who are prepared to say they're going to vote Labour. I've met them throughout the whole of the region.
Is this the South West region?
This is the South West region, yeah. And I think those people will carry on supporting the Labour Party because they know that lots of things need addressing, but the European elections means we need people from the Labour Party who are supporters of what we're trying to achieve coming out and voting. And I don't see this negativity that some other parties say coming out in the European elections. I think a lot of people have politics on their mind and will cast their vote accordingly. And I've met a lot of people who will say that they will support the Labour Party in the European elections.
What does your party think about all the rules and regulations coming from Europe? Can we moderate it a bit or not?
Well, we can moderate it, and we have, Labour government representatives in the Council of Ministers who go through these, and Labour MEPs who can amend them. And a lot of these so-called rules and regulations are there for our protection in the main course.
When French don't adhere to them, do they?
Well, every country adheres to them in their own legislation, and it has to be incorporated in their own legislation to do so. In some ways, in some countries, it's different to others, and that's what the European Parliament and the Commission are there to make sure that countries do. It's going to be different in different countries, but there we've got things like the Working Time Directive and pollution control, environmental controls, and so some of these, and also financial regulation, which is quite important these days with what some of the bankers got away with. And so when people say all these rules and regulations, they're there for a lot of people's protection. I think it's very important that people express their opinion and their view in the European election, because whilst we know that on a Europe-wide basis...
How many MEPs have you got?
Labour currently has one MEP, that's Glyn Ford. The South West region this time goes down from 7 to 6, so there's obviously one fewer MEP elected to represent the South West. But I'm confident that Glyn Ford and his record and the number of people who said they're going to vote Labour will be re-elected. It will be for the other parties to see where the seat goes from. But we'll see. Last time round, UKIP managed to get 2 seats. I don't know whether that's going to happen this time round.
What do you think would be the main issue for Labour in terms of climate change and the European Union?
I think the main issue on climate change is going to be the Copenhagen Agreement. Now, Britain has led the way with reducing CO2 emissions by greater than the amount that's being proposed at an EU level. But we want to be, the Labour Party wants to be at the centre of Europe, leading by showing what we can do nationally, and therefore our Labour MEPs driving that in a lead from the front position to show that we're not just all about talk, we're actually about action.
What other issues be on the agenda?
I think there'll be, obviously, the expenses issues is an important one. It's on a lot of people's minds. Now, the Labour Party and Labour MEPs have had their expenses audited independently since the year 2000. So there won't be any of these great revelations that have affected all the political parties at the Westminster Parliament. But obviously everyone's concerned. I think the rules again change in the next Parliament, where all parties and all MEPs will be required to publish their expenses. Now, the Labour Party has said this should include all receipts. I'm not sure whether the other parties, Lib Dems or Tories, have gone that far, but we want maximum light and maximum probity in taxpayers' money and where it's spent.
So how many more MEPs, Labour MEPs, do you think you'll get into the European Parliament after the next election?
I don't know exactly on the numbers.
I'm
hoping for people to look at our record and vote accordingly. And if they do that and see that what we've achieved, Labour MEPs, we will get more Labour MEPs elected. Because it's not all about just business, it's about protection of your environment and also protection of your rights. And there's a balance, and that balance has been achieved well by Labour. It's one where business and personal life and the environment all come together.
Anthea Page interviewing Keir Dillon from the Labour Party. When asked about the specific human rights questions, Keir only had a limited time for response, but in terms of trafficking, he said Labour should support victims as far as possible, which could hopefully mean that the Labour government would support a more comprehensive implementation of the Convention on Human Trafficking.
You're listening to Dialect Radio, one of the programmes produced for the Bristol Radio Co-op, run by volunteers.
This interview is with the United Kingdom Independence Party. My name's Dr. Julia Reid, and I am the number 4 MEP candidate in the South West.
Julia, could you tell us what your party's position is on EU rules and regulations?
Well, we believe that there are far too many. When we first joined the Common Market in 1973, we were told it was a free trade organisation. But since then, the European Union has brought out all sorts of rules and regulations that are beginning to impinge on our everyday lives. 84% of our laws now come from Europe. This is a figure that was given by one of the Conservative MEP candidates on Question Time, and all our MPs in Westminster do now is just rubber stamp them. And it's through these laws that we're losing things like the post office. Royal Mail is being destroyed through unfair competition from the Dutch company TNT and the German company DHL. Companies that make barometers and thermometers using mercury are being forced to go out of business. It's unbelievable. Vitamins, the vitamins that you want to take every day, you're not going to be able to get them in the values required to if you want to protect yourself from things like cancer or heart disease.
What's the UK Independent Party's stance on food production?
After the war, when we were only 40% self-sufficient in food, the government put forward plans so that production would increase. And by the 1960s, which was just before we joined the Common Market, we were 60% sufficient in growing food. And this was due to go up to 70%. But once we joined the Common Market, it was a political decision by the European Union that countries whose economies were more agriculturally based, they should have priority. And the more efficient farmers, such as those in Britain and those in Holland, were discriminated against. And now we're at the situation where Britain only provides 40% of its own food.
Is it true that we import milk? No.
I believe that for certain things, yes, we do import milk. But the ridiculous thing is that the quota system prevents our farmers from producing more milk as and when it's required. Last year, American farmers were exporting gallons and gallons and gallons of milk to China and India. The Chinese have developed a taste for yogurt, and Indians just cannot get enough milk. And they were making millions of dollars out of this export trade. But of course, our British farmers were unable to take advantage of this because we're not allowed to negotiate our own export deals. We have to have all our exports negotiated for us through the European Union, who not only are negotiating on our behalf, they're also negotiating on behalf of the other 26 member states. And they have to take the interests of the other member states into consideration, as well as ours, when these deals are being negotiated.
Do you think the average garden will be a luxury? Do you think everyone should be growing vegetables and being more self-sufficient?
I think it would. It's a good idea to be more self-sufficient. The problem with the common agricultural policy is, in countries like ours, we're being encouraged to grow things like biofuels. There's a farmer in Yorkshire. He's got a massive, great big field, and it took him 3 years to grow a biofuel crop that was sufficiently bulky enough to fit on a lorry. So that's 3 years of growth from this huge field. Now, that will be taken to Drax, which is a power station in Yorkshire, and that will be gone in a minute. So 3 years cultivation from this huge, great big field will be burnt in Drax in a minute.
So it's not efficient?
No, but you see, the thing is, straw from wheat would be just as good. So in those 3 years, he could have been growing wheat, and the wheat could have gone on either for human food or for animal fodder. And then the straw that's left behind, which is of no use to anybody other than animal bedding, that could have gone to Drax. So, I mean, it's a ridiculous policy that we're spending farmers to grow things that we can't eat, when we could be, you know, paying them to grow stuff we can eat, and the byproduct would be just as good to burn in a power station as the biofuel crop.
Is the idea of the Independent Party to break away from Europe and be totally independent, as it were, of Brussels?
Yes. We would like to withdraw from the European Union, but we don't want to totally stop the relationship that we have. We've been told by the people who run the European Union that if Britain wanted to withdraw, we could, and still have the beneficial trading rights that countries such as Norway and Switzerland have, but would have a looser association with them. So we'd be able to govern ourselves more, and we wouldn't have to pay these vast amounts of money, which we do at the moment. At the moment, it costs us £40 million a day net to be a member of the European Union.
Why is it so expensive?
Because it's only us and the Germans that pay for the European Union. All the other countries receive money. So it's the Germans and us that are subsidising the European Union. And this £40 million a day is shortly to go up to £60 million a day, because Tony Blair gave away the rebate that Margaret Thatcher won for us.
Are you finding that more and more people are switching to the Independent Party because they are so fed up with Europe and the regulations?
I think so. But particularly when people hear about things like the post office, as I said earlier. There's three European regulations that were brought in to deregulate our post office and the Royal Mail. It's about monopolies, because Europe don't like monopolies, even if they're beneficial ones. So, as I said, Royal Mail had to allow DHL and TNT to come in and cherry pick the business post, which is the lucrative part of the postal system that Royal Mail used to use to subsidise the universal post. So what they do is these companies, they go to where the utility bills are produced and where the bank statements are produced, collect them, and then they just dump them on poor Royal Mail to sort them and deliver them. So these companies, DHL and TNT, are being subsidised by Royal Mail. And a survey of the businesses found that, in actual fact, the cost of business post to businesses in this country hasn't gone down by very much at all. So the only people who are actually making money is the Dutch company TNT and the German company DHL, and they're being subsidised by our poor post office.
So that's just a typical example.
Yes.
But do you think people, because of the credit crunch, would worry about withdrawing from Europe in case it would make the situation worse?
Well, if we were to withdraw from Europe tomorrow, we could instantly take back our waters, our coastal waters, which are full of fish. So immediately we would start earning money from the fish that are still in the sea, and it would be only us that would be catching them. We'd save this 40 million, which will be £60 million a day, and we'd be free to negotiate our own export deals. I mean, at the moment, we do most of our trading, most of our export trading is actually with the rest of the world. When they tell you that we trade most with Europe, that is true, but the fact is we import far more from Europe than we export. So, you know, the world would be our oyster, and we could start trading more successfully than we do at the moment, because at the moment we're handicapped because, as I said, all our export deals have to be negotiated through Brussels.
Why don't the successive governments look at the EU situation and then say, well, it's not working for us, why don't we withdraw? Why do they keep on with it?
Well, that is the billion-dollar question, isn't it? Why? Whether or not they get some benefits out of it personally, I don't know. But definitely, if you just look that since we've been a member of the European Union, the common market as it was then, it's decimated our fishing industry. Fishing used to be the third largest industry in this country. 60% of European fish stocks were in our waters. We had thriving fishing ports all the way around the southwest, Devon and Cornwall, all the way up the east coast from Scotland all the way down to East Anglia for herring fishing. And it employed thousands of people. Now look at it. And under the law where all these government papers are released after 30 years, we can now see that Ted Heath knew perfectly well when he took us into the common market that he was going to sacrifice the fishing industry just to go into the common market.
Would your party then put forward a new referendum on whether we stayed in Europe or not?
Yes. In the latest poll, I'm pretty certain it was 66% of people in Britain would like to withdraw from the European Union. So that's a marvellous result for us. And I was at a hustings the other day, and the questions coming from the audience to the Conservative MEP candidate shows that people are now more in touch and know far more about what's going on in the European Union than what they did before. And this is due in part, I hope, to our party. But we've also got other parties now that are saying the same things about Europe. It's not just us. Libertas, who want a referendum on the Lisbon Treaty, they're telling everybody what's happening. And even the Conservatives are saying what's happening. But what the Conservatives are saying is if the Lisbon Treaty is ratified by the time they get into Parliament, then they're not going to have a referendum and that we'll have to learn to live with it. But the problem with the Lisbon Treaty is once it's ratified by all member states, Britain can no longer withdraw unilaterally. We have to have the permission of other member states to leave. And as we're funding it, along with the Germans, who's going to give permission for us to go? So it could be irrevocable once the Lisbon Treaty has been ratified by all member states. Britain may be enslaved to the European Union forever. It's frightening, it really is.
If you were trying to persuade me to vote for you, what would be the chief issue that you would put forward for your party in the forthcoming election?
Well, it would be that withdrawal is the most important thing.
From Europe?
Yes. My father's father fought in the trenches during the First World War to save the sovereignty of our country. My father was in the Royal Navy during the Second World War. His brother flew in Halifaxes over Germany. My mother's father was also in the Royal Air Force during the Second World War, and they fought to save the sovereignty of our country, for our people, for our descendants, you know, for my son and my grandson, everybody else's children, to live in freedom. And yet, successively, since the 1970s, Conservative and Labour governments have given away our sovereignty to Europe. So that, as I said before, 84% of our laws now come from Europe. And it's treasonous, really, that the sovereignty that our ancestors fought to keep for us has just been given away. So that's what I would say. I'd say that if you value the freedom of for your children and your grandchildren to grow up in a country that's free to do what it would like to do, then that's why they should vote for our party. If anybody out there is interested in learning more about the United Kingdom Independence Party, we have a main countrywide website. If you just Google UKIP, that will bring up our head office website. And here in the Southwest, if you Google UKIP Southwest, it will bring up the Southwest website.
That interview was with Dr. Julia Reid from the UK Independence Party. Firstly, on the subject of the environment, Julia quoted the Stern Report as saying that we need to pay 1% to 2% GDP in green taxes in order to mitigate against climate change. However, the UK government were already doing that, and the green taxes we have in place, fuel duty, air passenger duty, and the landfill tax to name a few, were already getting 1% to 2% GDP. So therefore, we were already on target. This promoted a slight laugh from the audience. She did say that this was UKIP policy, and that apparently not all scientists agree with climate change. What she did note was that permits for the EU emissions trading scheme had been dreamt up. She quoted the situation in Germany, where large companies are given many permits to trade. This is what happens in a trading system, and this is technically known as grandfathering. If a company was historically emitting CO2 and a new trading scheme is put in place, it's unfair to say that that company that was already emitting a large amount of carbon dioxide should be limited to the same extent as a smaller company. So the grandfathering policy is where companies that have traditionally emitted more and they have been legally allowed to in the framework of that country should get more credits in order to trade in that scheme.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
The last candidate is from the Conservative Party.
My name is Ashley Fox, and I'm one of six Conservative candidates standing for the European Parliament on the 4th of June.
So, Ashley, the referendum is a big item on your list. Can you explain what that means?
Yes, I can. In 2004, the European Union designed a constitution, and that constitution transferred significant powers from the nation states to Brussels. Now, as many people will know, that constitution was rejected in two referenda, first by France and then by the Netherlands. And so the constitution, we thought, was dead. But a couple of years later, the European Union decided to resurrect that constitution, and back it came with a new title, the Lisbon Treaty. But to all intents and purposes, it was identical. So, for example, it proposed setting up a common defence policy, a common foreign policy, a common immigration policy, a common asylum policy. And this country lost about 60 vetoes in areas of other policy. So it represented a very significant transfer of power from Britain to the European Union. Now, at the last general election in 2005, the Labour Party, the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives all said that they would have a referendum on the European Constitution. Now, we say that the Lisbon Treaty is virtually identical to the Constitution, and we are therefore very concerned that Gordon Brown has refused to have a referendum on the Lisbon Treaty, because it's the same as the Constitution, it just has a different name. And we're also concerned that the Liberal Democrats have failed to abide by their promise to have that referendum. So what we're saying is that these European elections on the 4th of June are the last opportunity the public have to make their voice heard. And a vote for the Conservative Party is a vote to have a referendum on the Lisbon Treaty.
When is the Lisbon Treaty likely to happen?
The Lisbon Treaty, as I understand it, has been ratified by 23 of the 27 member states. So there are four left to ratify it. The Czech Republic and Poland are awaiting the outcome of the Irish referendum. And you may remember that the Irish have already voted no to this treaty. And I think it's extraordinary that the Irish are being bullied into having a second referendum to say yes before the British people have even had one referendum. And this, I think, shows the mentality of the Brussels elite. They don't respect the views of small nations. Ireland has said no, and that should be respected. And I think it is wrong that they are being made to vote again.
So will they make us vote again if we go against it?
Well, what the Conservative Party have said is if we come to power before that treaty is ratified, we will hold a referendum as quickly as possible. And we believe that we can hold that referendum before all the other countries have ratified it, and we will then withdraw our ratification and the Lisbon Treaty will come to a grinding halt. We sincerely hope that the Irish will abide by their first decision and that they will vote no a second time.
So do you think that the majority of people will vote against the Lisbon Treaty in this country?
I think they probably will. But to be honest, that isn't important. I'm a Democrat. So if the British people decide that the Lisbon Treaty is a good thing, if they want more powers to go from Westminster to Brussels, if they vote for that, then I won't be happy, but I will abide by the result like a good Democrat. What I find absolutely extraordinary is that the last election, the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats said they were in favour of a referendum. And since then, they've stood on their heads and they're now denying the British people that right.
How will you get the information about the Lisbon Treaty to the man in the street? He might say, oh, don't know anything about that. I mean, it's quite complicated, isn't it?
Well, the treaty itself is exceptionally complicated, yes. But I think you underestimate the ability of the public to form a view on a set of principles. You don't need to read the whole Lisbon Treaty to understand that a large number of powers are being transferred to Brussels. And I've mentioned foreign policy, defence policy, immigration, asylum and many others. Now, people, I think, have a broad view as to whether they think it is good for Brussels to have more power or it's bad. I happen to think it's bad. I happen to think that one of the reasons we have such apathy in this country, the reason that many people don't bother to vote, is because they don't see their vote making much of a difference. And I believe that that problem will be exacerbated the more and more power is transferred away from our Westminster Parliament. And that's why I don't want to see any more power transferred.
Going on to the rainforest now, how do we prevent the rainforests in South America being cut down to make soya bean fields?
That was a very interesting question that we dealt with in the debate. And the difficulty is that at the present time, the rainforests have no monetary value to the developing nations. We in the West exhort them not to cut them down, having already cut down most of the forests in our own country, but we do very little about it. And I think it's hypocritical for us to just lecture developing nations about this and to do nothing at all about it. Now, my solution to this is twofold. First of all, if we in the West believe that retaining these rainforests is so very important, we ought to do something positive about it. We could, for example, take out a 1,000-year lease on areas of rainforest, effectively to rent them from the developing nations, or possibly to buy them if they're willing to sell, to ensure that they're not developed. Now, the problem about soya beans being cultivated and then being imported into our country for animal feed Again, part of the difficulty is that the cost of aviation fuel and the cost of shipping fuel is not subject to any form of tax. Now, if we are serious about reducing CO2 emissions, we have to deal with that anomaly. That's not something that Britain can deal with on its own. We need a global agreement. And what we need to do is to ensure that the costs on the environment of shipping and aviation fuel are reflected in a suitable tax on those fuels. In other words, to discourage the transport, for example, of soybeans from Latin America to our country. Now, I don't know what level of tax is required. You could call it, if you like, a carbon tax, a tax on carbon to reduce emissions. I'm talking about general principles here, but I think the adoption of such a tax could go a long way to protecting the rainforests and also to reducing carbon dioxide emissions.
Well, it seems like a very good idea. Why haven't people thought of that already?
Well, I don't claim to be the originator of this idea. I'm sure it has been thought of before. But you'll appreciate that in the middle of a global recession, talking about imposing additional taxes on shipping and on aviation is not a very popular idea. It'll make those businesses' lives even more difficult than it already is. And it might be that if you're being practical, we have to wait a couple of years until the global economy has recovered before such taxes can be considered. I want to emphasise, we in Britain, or even we in the European Union, couldn't act unilaterally on this. We can't impose a tax on our industries unilaterally that then puts them at an enormous competitive disadvantage. This has to be part of a global deal that seeks to reduce carbon dioxide emissions and tackles aviation fuel and shipping fuel at the same time. So the whole world has to act together on this.
Ashley, what's your party going to do to increase accountability in the European Union?
Well, what David Cameron has said is that all MEPs will, from June when they're elected, publish all their expenses, and they will also publish any details of any hospitality that they receive from lobby groups or producers or anyone like that, so that everyone knows what our MEPs are spending their money on and from whom they receive any hospitality. We also want to reduce waste and fraud within the European Union, and the way to achieve that is the greatest degree of transparency possible. I would like to see the Council of Ministers acting in public, meeting in public, publishing all their minutes. I want to see greater openness and transparency in the way the EU monitors its accounts, because the EU is renowned for wasting money, and this trip to Strasbourg every month is a prime example of that. And if we're trying to cut down on waste, what I'd love to see is Parliament having a permanent home in Brussels, so that we no longer have the waste and cost of having two parliaments, which are completely unnecessary.
So do you think MPs here should have a place in London where they can stay rather than going to hotels?
I think probably if you're a member of Parliament and you live a long distance from London, then it is reasonable to have a second home. For example, if I were a Bristol MP, I couldn't commute to London on a daily basis. So I would need a modest flat or something. And I think most people have no problem with that. What I think people find truly objectionable are some of the very extravagant claims that have come forward, people spending tens of thousands of pounds on gardening, or, dare I say, a small number of examples of MPs claiming for mortgages which simply don't exist.
Ashley, what's your party's view on the working time directives?
The Conservative Party is opposed to the working time directive because we see this as unnecessary interference by Brussels in the hours of work that we in Britain choose to work. And it affects us on a number of different levels. For example, people starting their new businesses, entrepreneurs, why should they be restricted to only working 48 hours a week? It's simply none of Brussels' business. Someone struggling with their mortgage payment at the moment might want to do some more overtime to make sure they can pay that mortgage. Why should Brussels interfere and tell them they can't work those extra hours? And more importantly, the changes that Brussels has been trying to push through recently, and I'm glad to say have been defeated, they sought to include within working time, time spent on call. Now that might sound a bit technical, but for example, if you're a retained fireman in a rural area, it is absurd that time spent on call counts towards your working time. As a retained fireman, you might be a plumber or a butcher or something, and you might work your 36 or 40 hours a week in your normal job, and then you could be on call for any number of hours, but not actually be called out. And what we say is it's only time when you're actually called out, helping the fire service, that should count towards that. And what we will find is that if Brussels have their way, if Labour MEPs have their way, and it's Labour MEPs who have been pressing to tighten these restrictions on the Working Time Directive, we will find that retained firefighters across the southwest of England are being laid off. And even more importantly, it will affect the health service. Time spent on call by junior doctors and others will count towards their working hours. Now, we just say this is unnecessary bureaucracy, unnecessary interference. Brussels should back off and scrap the whole directive.
So, Ashley, to summarise, what are the main issues in the forthcoming election will the Conservative Party be concentrating on?
Well, our main priority at this election is to campaign for a referendum on the Lisbon Treaty. And what we're saying is that no power should be transferred to Brussels without the consent of the British people. Our second policy is greater accountability and transparency of the EU, and in particular in the way that MEPs publish their expenses. We're going for maximum openness. We've already applied that to our own MEPs, and we will campaign to ensure it applies to all the other MEPs within the Parliament. And the third policy that we're going to campaign on is the Working Time Directive, because we believe that hard-working families should be able to work as many hours as they choose with their employer without Brussels interfering unnecessarily.
Thank you.
That last interview was with Ashley Fox. One of the main policies underlying the Conservatives is trade liberalisation. Ashley talked about free trade, fair trade.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I hope that this review of the event has been useful. We at Amnesty feel that the event was very worthwhile, and it did stimulate an interesting debate around issues regarding the environment and human rights. The candidates gave some useful insights as to their party's policies, so that people can weigh up in their own minds what issues are most important to them and vote accordingly. Human rights issues are always politically sensitive, and although the candidates generally gave very positive responses, we will have to wait to see if they have the vision and resolve to push further and actually take action if elected to the European Parliament. That's all for this week's Radio Dialect special. The reporter and producer of the show was Anthea Page. It's goodbye for me too. Tim Elliott, Vice Chair of the Bristol Amnesty International Group and presenter on this week's show. To find out more about Amnesty, you can Google Bristol Amnesty or go to www.amnesty.org.uk/Bristol. Or come along to our next meeting on Monday the 15th of June, held at the Redland Reformed Church on White Ladies Road. Goodbye.